Welcome to the Untoxicated Podcast.
Well, I'm Sherry Salas, and that was my husband, Matt.
We have questions about the impact of alcohol and addiction on relationships.
If you have those kinds of questions, too, you're in the right place.
Here we go. Welcome to what promises to be one of the most interactive and maybe even humorous episodes of the Untoxicated Podcast ever. Sherry, good to see you.
Good to see you.
We've got some great friends on with us. Some of the folks that are on this roundtable podcast have been with us since the very beginning of the Echoes of Recovery program. And all five of our panelists are people we have just grown to really respect and love. And so we've got some great opinions coming your way. Not just me and you today, Sherry. I know these are your favorites.
Yeah.
Less Talky for Yui is your favorite.
It's nice to have guests, hear other opinions, and I am excited about our panel as well. I wish we had been recording our conversation.
The free conversation?
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
It was.
So I think it will be a lot of fun because I think we're all at a good point where we can laugh about the things that we're going to talk about that happened in the past. And
speaking of something that's really funny, intimacy in an alcoholic relationship. Sex is really funny. We just want to remind our listeners that the Alcoholic Intimacy Survey is still open. If you are the partner of someone who experiences alcohol use disorder currently or in the past 5 years, we would love for you to take our survey. We have at least twice as many responses as we originally anticipated. So it's going great, but we would love to get some more. We want more perspectives, more points of view. So if that describes you, the partner of an alcoholic, we would love you to go to alcoholicintimacysurvey.org and take our survey. Tell us about your experiences. Hopefully we can learn a lot from you. I won't ask our panelists if they've all taken it, but I'm pretty sure they all have. So lots of nodding and smiling. As a professional researcher, I'm not supposed to ask questions like that, but I had a feeling. Welcome, welcome. On with us today is Nicole, Jane, Nikki, Lori, and Karen, really good friends and longtime members of Echoes of Recovery. And so we're going to dive right in with a listener question. And this question is not just for me and you, Sherry. We want our panelists to answer this. In fact, I've been saving this for quite a while because the listener asked for responses from a panel. And so we're going to give it to them. So I'll read the question and then we'll see what y'all think. I'm torn between supporting my husband's continued sobriety and enjoying a glass of wine. I don't usually drink at home, but he says it's stupid for me not to drink when we are out. In the beginning, I'm sure he felt it looked less conspicuous. I don't want to stop having my wine with dinner or enjoying a drink with my newly of age daughters. I definitely feel like the easy answer is to stop drinking. But frankly, I lost so much from the time enjoying life while he was actively drinking that I kind of just don't want to. I'm just being honest, looking for other opinions on this, but mostly looking for insight into how difficult it might be making sobriety for my husband, even though he says it doesn't matter. All right, panel, what do you think? What's your drinking status? And do you take into consideration the sobriety of your partner? Who wants in? Nicole, come on in.
A lot to say about that.
Yes.
My personal experience when I first found out my husband was an alcoholic, I gave it up to make things easier on him. And he encouraged me throughout his so-called sobriety. Oh, you can have a drink. It really won't bother me. And he was drinking on the side during that time. Since he has discovered recovery and has been sober for almost a year, he doesn't encourage me anymore, although he does say he doesn't think it would bother him, but we don't keep alcohol in the house. However, we have two daughters who are of age, and when I visit them alone without him present, feel free to have a glass of wine because sometimes I want a glass of wine. But for the most part, I simply don't drink and definitely don't keep it in the house. I feel like that would be, in my experience, just like taunting, you know, and I wouldn't, because we're trying to recover, or to use, I think it's Jane's word, discover our marriage, I wouldn't do it in front of him if it was, you know, somewhere where that we were together.
Thanks, Nicole. Love that. Lori, what do you think? Lori, you are muted. Come on in.
Sorry about that. I was saying I can definitely relate to the caller's experience. You know, when my husband was drinking, he used to actually get mad at me if I didn't drink. And when he was drinking, I intentionally stopped drinking because I needed to be okay to drive. And I also wanted to give that role model to our kids who were younger then and to let them know, hey, you don't ever have to worry about your safety. I will never drink. I will be the one. And so given all that, at this point, I kind of don't want to drink much anymore. But now that he's sober, he has said it doesn't bother him at all if I drink. And so there's once in a while, you know, at a party or with friends, I might have a drink around him. I mean, I think like Nicole, I'm more comfortable drinking when I'm not around him. But I think, you know, the listener's question, it sounds to me like she wants to, and her husband has said it's okay. So to me, that sounds like maybe an opportunity for her to go ahead and to give him a chance to build some trust. I mean, he said he's okay with it. You know, I don't know exactly what her hesitation is. Maybe she's not sure she can trust him, or she is concerned it might trigger him in some way. But so it's one of those many things that just becomes weird when one's drinking and one's not. And it's just, it's one of those things you just have to work through and decide, you know, what you really want for yourself, what's going to be best for you.
I'm glad you said that it becomes weird. I couldn't agree more. I think all of us alcoholics say, oh, it won't bother me. Go ahead and drink. But what's behind that? I think that differs among many of us. Nikki, what's your experience?
So similar, but I had two instances where, so Josh always was like, yes, like you can drink, like you're a normie, you know, like you're not, it's not an issue. I'm not going to be affected by it. And I'm always just like, but why would I? Like, I have so much hurt and pain and trauma surrounding that, that I don't know how I could drink without ever just thinking about it every time I did. But I had two instances where we were together at a function and I was pressured into drinking. And I'm pretty sure I posted about each thing in Echoes when it happened because I was beside myself. One was at a birthday party for my mom, and her friend encouraged everyone to take a shot of tequila. Of course, Josh didn't. But I felt very, very weird taking the shot in front of him because it wasn't just like a glass of wine. Like, we're talking a shot of tequila. So it felt even more, I just felt an extreme amount of guilt because even though he says that it's okay, part of me thinks that it's not, but he just doesn't want to tell me that because he doesn't want to ruin whatever experience that I want with it, knowing that I'm not an addict to it. And then another time was at like another celebration type function, and I had one and I barely drank it and ended up giving it away because I just couldn't stop thinking about everything that stood behind it for me. And so it wasn't worth it to me to just like, I mean, I was never a glass of wine a day kind of person at dinner or anything, but even so, it just wasn't worth my mental jungle gym of a brain to go through the hoops of like whether it feels right or not right.
Yeah, totally understandable. Karen, how about you?
Okay. My experience was a little different.
I like that you set it up with the okay. Okay, buckle up, buttercup. Here I come.
Okay. I'm not going to use all the words. But anyway, my husband was the sneaking, hiding, lying kind. And when it all turned to chaos and he went to recovery, and he didn't live at home for 7 months, okay? And I was one of those, like a lot of us are, I jumped in and I had to learn everything, you know, and that was like part of my trauma recovery. And when he did come back, and I know they always say, don't have it in the house or don't drink with them. And I didn't drink with him. but I didn't take it out of the house because we live a block from a liquor store, or a block and a half. And I thought, this guy is either going to stay sober or he's not. You know, it wasn't encouraged, but I also wasn't going to change everything. Now, when we went out the first time and he was encouraging me, and I very rarely drank around it, but we had the holiday gathering that first year and people drink at it. And he was real clear about how he didn't want to impeach his decision on anybody else. Now, he'd been struggling with this for like 9 years. If he didn't get it then, it was fine because I wasn't going to be in it. But and I took him by the hand and I said, let's go outside, because I could tell it was uncomfortable and he just didn't want to be in it. And I don't think he felt he connected as well with other people without it, you know. And I think what he didn't want to have was more of a shame focus on him, you know, that he was weird or unusual. And then in a spring later, one of our sons came to visit and was staying in his brother's house, and we were there, and he'd left them a bottle of wine, and they opened it and they looked at me and they go, is that okay? And I'm like, he knows it's his problem. But he was like a couple years recovered by then. Mm-hmm. So it was like, I, you know, very rarely go out, but you know, if I'm going out with the family and there's a margarita involved, I might drink one or two, but it's just not, it wasn't a problem for me.
Yeah. You know, doesn't sound like it's a big part of your life either way. Yeah.
No. You do realize how different people change and nobody's really themselves. Cause one time I did go out and I had a drink with him and I'm like, I like him better when I'm drinking. I'm thinking, this is not a good thing.
Okay.
Because
Jane,
it does kind of numb you out.
Jane, you're nodding and snapping. What did you relate to at the end of what Karen said?
So I decided to be sober like before my husband got sober. I think I had a lot of traumatic things happen within my relationship. And then I watched a lot of my echo sisters go through some really dark stuff with their drinkers. And it flipped me over to the side that if you replace the word drink with meth, and you think about how that looks like. So the words that stuck out in the question was, it'd be stupid for you not to have meth every once in a while. It'd be, you already lost so much. Why should you have to give up meth? Like, that's the how my brain works now. Like, this is a poison that we all flirt with. And I've watched too many good people fall to it that I just, that's the like extreme belief I have about it. And then, like Karen said, even with them, with friends who do have a drink or two, I watched them just like kind of float out of their bodies. And then it's like we're not even in the same space. And so I think, you know, we relate. People say, well, I don't get along with other people unless I'm drinking. And I'm like, that really makes me question, where are we when we're all in that same room at that, you know, altered state? Are we really interacting with each other, or is that, you know, the high of the alcohol? And so I've had such like more deep conversations with people sober over like freaking pancakes than I ever have with a drink. And so for the listener question, I would just say, play with it and be intuitive with it. Like, how does this make me feel? How does it make me feel when other people are doing it? And you got to make your decision for yourself, just like the alcoholic has to. But for me, after like 6 months of not drinking, it was like easy. And now it's just like, when I smell it, it makes my, like, you know, some people don't like the smell of fresh fish. Like, it just makes their stomach turn. The smell of alcohol does that. So it's real easy to not now.
That's great. That's great. Very insightful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nikki puts mic drop in the chat. Yeah. That was great. And I'm really glad that you said that so that those words didn't come out of my mouth. So I sound like the teetotaling ex-alcoholic lecturer. Well,
and I feel
asshole
like
guy.
If I were to say that, I'd be the teetotaling wife of a, you know, yeah. But cool. I kind of relate with a lot with what Jane says. I have a group of people that I hang out with occasionally, and about 2 hours in, I'm like, I'm done. because there are people that just drink more. And the, and like Karen said, the changing, watching those people change, it just triggers me. It makes me sad. And I don't want to have those memories when I'm around them the next time, you know? Right. So I like always like, oh, I want to leave now and make sure I have a way to do that. So
I do want to, I don't know, honor or acknowledge the situation that the listener describes. I left out the first sentence in her email. It said, I know your stance on alcohol from listening to the podcast. So that's why I wanted to, we wanted to get all five of you in before we responded. We went through all of it though. We, at the beginning, like she talks about how her husband said that he wanted her to drink so that we didn't look conspicuous. I used to make Sherry drink when we would go out when I was sober, because I thought we looked, we would look weird if two people and a couple aren't drinking. And I love your meth. If two people and a couple aren't doing meth, how weird do they look?
What I laughed when we started that was, I was like, these are people that we've hung out with for years, Matt. You not drinking and forcing the alcohol on me, that looks very weird if anybody's paying any attention, which we found out nobody really does pay attention to what others are doing. So,
especially the more they drink.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You guys did great handling the listener question. Let's handle some questions that Sherry and I have prepared for you. The topic of our roundtable episode today is kind of the stay side of the should I stay or should I go relationship question. We have addressed the other side. We've addressed separation and divorce. And it was suggested to us by another dear friend that we've been working with and known for a long time that, hey, what about the people that, that, you know, we say choose your hard, right? Divorce is hard. Staying in an alcoholic relationship is hard. How about talking to the people whose hard choice was to stay? And my first question, and let me bring this to you, Jane. Let me come back to you. Is stay really a decision, or is it just where you are now? Does that make sense?
I think that's a daily choice. I think we put a lot of pressure on ourselves in the beginning to make that decision. And the reality is all the choices usually suck. So it's not like an easy decision. And I had most of my decision during a pandemic. So stay or go, but go where and do what? And so it had to kind of turn into a daily decision to figure out how I can just, you know, in the beginning, survive the day and focus on the things that I could control. But even as, you know, the years have passed, it's now a conscious decision to just accept what is today and do and be where I am today. And that tomorrow might be different, but right now I'm okay. I'm okay where I'm at. I'm okay with the decisions I've made, where I'm living today. And I'm learning so much just sitting with what is, that I just trust myself, know that, and now that if something else needs to happen, or, you know, like I think we have this belief in the beginning of relationships that we make this decision that we're going to be forever, together forever. And like you make that decision and that's the commitment, period, end of story. And we've been married long enough and go through enough crap. You kind of realize you can't guarantee that. Like you just can't. And those people who tell you, know, it's just a daily decision. Like you're like, but now I'm like, yup, daily decision. You know, so it's, I wish I hadn't have put so much pressure on myself back then. And that's kind of how I advise people now, is like, take that off the table and what you can do today. Like, and if there's things you got to do, well, what's one thing you can take a step towards? But that pressure to figure it all out or run away or stay or whatever every day will make you sick, real sick.
It's interesting. A part of your process clearly is that you've gotten more confident in your own ability to make that daily decision and knowing who you are and knowing how you're going to react in different situations. And so your own self-confidence, self-esteem makes the daily decision kind of more doable, it seems. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because I'm okay with myself.
Yeah, like, exactly.
You know, no matter what, I trust that I'm going to figure it out. So yeah. I don't feel that pressure that I also have to figure out what he's going to do.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Lori, what do you think about this? What's your response to that question?
So I think the decision part of this is key. And for me, that's when everything shifted, because I think for a long time, at least for me, I felt like I didn't have another option. And so when you're staying because you feel like you don't have a choice, that's really unhealthy and really hard. And when I realized that actually I can stay and work on being well while I stay, that changed everything for me. And so I think pretty much anything we do, if it's a conscious, thought out decision, it's always going to be much better than just a default or an avoiding kind of thing. So I do think, and like Jane, especially early on, it was a daily decision. And again, it was like, I couldn't handle a long-term decision. I didn't have the capacity. So I told myself, well, decide every day. Do you want to stay today? Mm-hmm. And I've moved off of that. I mean, he's been sober 5 years and I don't think much about not staying anymore, other than I know in the back of my mind that's always an option. I can always change. But I think that's progress, is that I've evolved away from having to think about it every day. And now it is just kind of the way things are.
Yeah, absolutely. Nikki, is stay a decision for you, or is it just where you are now?
It was definitely a decision, but when I hear people talk about choice and it being like a daily choice, my brain just automatically keeps going to, I don't like that word, because it makes me feel like I'm on our worst day. I'm choosing to be with and put myself through these like awful times, especially in the beginning when in early sobriety, it was really nasty. And it, to think that I chose that feels really ick on my end. But obviously, like, we're 4.5 years down and like things are better now. And choice doesn't seem as scary. But in the beginning, it felt weird to just like use that word, because I didn't want to choose that. I didn't want to choose how we would go through this horrible period of our life to get to this point. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's definitely a decision now. But before, it just, I don't know. It's not
just trying to survive.
Yeah, it was survive. Yeah.
Oh, so interesting. Karen, I've often thought it might be easier to start over, because rebuilding trust is a lot harder than starting from scratch with no trust at all. What do you think about that?
Well, I agree. I think, and at first I didn't, because I think you got to establish trust with that other person. And you don't know if you can trust the new person either. But I already know this guy betrayed me. I already have wounds from this one, you know? And so I had to heal that in me. And that's not been easy at all, to feel that massive pain, that emotional pain from it. And at least, I mean, I wouldn't know, but I think I trust myself a lot better now starting something new, just because of who I am now, because of all the recovery that I've done. So, and I think in our experience, and I'm pretty attuned to my emotions a lot more anyway, but it had not been true for him for a very long time, you know, because alcohol does all that coping for me. So the emotional piece of it was really hard, you know, where I'd want to express it. And then I'd get this shutdown response back, because he wasn't comfortable with that. And I know I wouldn't date or marry somebody like that today. I just know it. I know that about me. So day or so go.
So where does that put you in the initial question of, is it a decision or is it where you are now?
Well, you know, he had an emotional relapse. So I basically had to start over on my healing with that. But yesterday we're seeing an emotionally focused therapist, which is awesome, except when it's not. And so there's an encouragement, and I think a lot of men are conditioned not to feel feelings in this society. You know, it's like you're not supposed to be sad or empathetic or
anger. Anger's the only one we get.
Anger's the only emotion. And it's,
yeah, that's right.
I'm not going to swear, but it is not good to make your decisions with anger, you know, a lot of times. So I hate the stuckness. You know, because I think the stuckness, and he had stayed stuck for a long time, but I had a lot of stuckness released out of me yesterday. And it was so painful and so good because I got it out of me with two witnesses, both male. It was great. So today, and then he handled it more empathetically and cared. So a lot of it for me is, how is he showing up for me? Because he was not showing up for me. And he did chores and that kind of reliability stuff. But you want to know somebody cares about you and can express it. Or I do. I know. And that's a lot from a liar to believe it anyway. But former liar. So today it's this day. You know. And we seem to be growing in the right direction, no matter how slow it's been. So today it's this day.
Today it's a stay. That might be the title of the episode. I got to think about another that, t-shirt. But I really like that, or at least a t-shirt. That's great. God, Karen, you make recovery sound messy. I thought I was going to bring you veterans on and you would tell everyone how easy this stuff is.
You're just wiser.
Nicole, what do you think about the trust issue? Is it easier to, would it be easier to start over from scratch than it is to rebuild broken trust? I know that's a hot topic for you, the rebuilding of broken trust.
It sure is. Early on, I would have said that the going was harder earlier on. I thought leaving, breaking up the family and all of that would have been harder. And I even said that to him when we were kind of in our separation. Now, I think it's easier for the alcoholic to move on. Like, I think if he were to start something with someone new, it'd be a lot easier for him. But for me, I've got this trauma. I've got trust issues. I'm going to carry those trust issues to whoever I would be with after this. And I mean, cause I look at other people's relationships, and not that I should be judging them, but when I hear somebody say something to somebody else, I'm like, I wonder if this, you know, I'm just super, super aware of the potential conniving that goes on, that, you know, how manipulative people can be. And so I really do think that it doesn't matter. I have to face the hard. It's gonna be hard for a long time, maybe forever. I'm hopefully not forever, but it's hard right now. It's been hard for a year, and it was hard before that because he had, you know, he was white knuckling for a time, and then he was secret drinking for a time. And so I think they're both hard, but for him, I think it would be easier to move on.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you guys for such authentic answers. Sherry, I'm not going to ask you if you have made a formal decision to stay or if it's just day to day, because I don't think I want to know the answers, but as long as those cats are still here, I know you're coming home, so that's just how I measure that.
Yeah, well, Nicole,
I'm not going to ask you.
I'm not going to answer you.
Okay, good. Thank you.
I think Nicole brought up a very good point that I hadn't really even considered in all of the years we've, like, talked about this, like, with our recovery groups, that it probably would be easier for the alcoholic, because then they get a fresh start with somebody that has no baggage, and they can be this new reinvented person. And then you're like, and then I'm just stuck with the memory of the shitty you. And then I'm going to carry that in to other relationships. So that's why we often say it's really important to you know, make sure that you're doing your own recovery as the partner of an addict. So
I feel like there are two trains of thought. There's a fork in that road. Certainly there are people who get divorced and the alcoholic pursues the divorce or acknowledges and accepts the divorce. But there are a lot of us, and I can't explain it. I think it goes back to what Karen was saying about how it's hard for men to express emotions. There are a lot of us that are glommed on to our wife in what is, during addiction and early sobriety, a really unhealthy way. But the glomming on doesn't go away in sobriety. And, you know, I would have been devastated had you left me. And I think there are a lot of men that would just be completely lost. Would we get over it? Would we figure it out? You know, probably. But I think from what I've learned from knowing all of you, I think the should I stay or should I go is more of a consistent decision point that gets revisited by on the loved one side than the alcoholic side. Whether we'd be better off because it'd be a clean slate or not, I don't think we can see that forest through the trees for most of us. I know I certainly couldn't. Never. I come home every day and check to see if those cats are here. It is really important to me.
The garage.
Well, I want to combine a couple of questions. And so my next question, do you accept your need for recovery and discovery? And does your partner, but also did you expect sobriety to fix everything right off the bat? Karen, what are your thoughts on those kind of combined questions?
Okay, so I knew from the beginning that I wanted to recover myself because I'd had a former relationship where he overused alcohol. I had a father that drank alcohol, and somehow I thought I would know and never be hurt by it. So I kind of jumped in on my recovery because I thought no matter what happens, I'm getting me back, you know, and I cared an awful lot about him, but I wasn't going to stay married to the crazy. I was going to get myself healed. I think it's so vitally important for everyone to do recovery that has been through something like that. Or, you know, and when I'm active in another, you know, recover from the adult child of an alcoholic group too. And I love it when people show up to recover from that. Or if somebody's had alcohol in their experience in any way, because it impacts the whole family and generations behind it. So yeah, I wanted myself healed. How selfish is that?
Oh, I think it's the only way. I think it's the only way to go. That's one thing that we've learned. We've got to focus on ourselves if we expect the relationship to get better. Laura, you mentioned that your husband's been sober for 5 years. At the time when he first got sober, did you think that was it? That was going to fix everything?
No. But I had no idea how hard it would be. I mean, I had been to Al-Anon in the past, and one of their kind of slogans is, you know, the bluebird of happiness does not take up residence when the drinker stops drinking. So I kind of had an expectation that everything wasn't going to change right away. But again, I was not prepared for how hard early sobriety in particular was, and how, in a lot of ways, his behavior seemed worse when he stopped drinking. And that was a huge shock and disappointment and very scary for me. So I think that's one thing that can help people who do decide to stay, you know, when their partner becomes sober, to expect it's probably going to get worse. And that was hard. That was very hard.
So I want to respond again.
Yes, Karen.
Okay, so for me, I am kind of a hopeful idealist in a kind of dopey way. So I did think that I had no idea that he would still not be changed, you know, without the alcohol. Because I thought, and I knew we had other issues, but I was still in love with a former version of him that he was not showing up as. And so for me, that was even more heartbreaking that I'd stayed. Like I stayed and this is, you know, the fish pond when you're a little kid and you get the wrong I stayed here and this is what I get. So that was even more heartbreaking for me that he was just still so stuck and ungrateful and appreciative that I'd stayed and had his back the whole time. So I would definitely say, hey, the alcohol has changed him and he doesn't know how to cope with life without it. That was my experience. So that gave me, I didn't understand it all, but I knew that he had to do the work, and I'd been doing so much of the emotional lifting. I just would take that energy and go focus on me again, because it was mm-hmm. not like getting this big reward for staying. That was my experience.
Yeah. We keep coming back to that, the importance of you doing your recovery, you focusing on you. It's not only helpful to the relationship, but it's helpful to you for your own growth. I mean, that's right. Why we call it discovery and not just recovery. You're not trying to go back to some predestined place. You're trying to get better. Nikki, I'm curious, your husband's very involved in AA. He's a leader in his local group. He and I've had lots of conversations. I'm very impressed with how active he's been and the proactive nature to his recovery. How did he feel about you going into recovery, you joining Echoes, you doing things for yourself? Was he supportive?
Not at all. Well, so, oh, do I want to share this in front of the whole world? I don't know. But he had this thing where he really wanted me to do Al-Anon. Because a lot of his AA people were like pushing him into thinking that I needed to do Al-Anon. And because this was so unheard of, and like it just seemed, I think, intimidating to him. And I think he thought I was going to join this group and they were going to tell me to leave him. And so I think there was a ton of fear for him. Initially, because he knew at that point, like, I was miserable. I was completely unhappy. I mean, his sobriety was an ultimatum, and it just happened to work in my favor, sort of. but yeah, I mean, he saw really that Echoes helped me greatly. And then once he got further into his sobriety, realized how much the change in me, but I for sure did not think I had to heal. I was very oblivious to that. I really thought he had to do all that work to heal our relationship. So for me, it was, I joined Echoes, but I don't know what I expected out of it. I didn't have, like, you know, Jane's the one who recruited me here, but she's just like, you have to join. And I'm like, okay, like, well, I don't know what I'm doing. And by that first call, though, I can remember like texting her after the call and just being like crying, like, I found my people. But it still took me a while to figure out that I had to heal from this, that there was work and I didn't want to do any work. Because, you know, for him, he thought that he was the one telling me that his sobriety would change everything. And I don't think he realized the actual work he had to put into his sobriety when he was saying that too. And it was a lot of dry drunk behavior, so it wasn't very convincing. So it was awful for a while, but.
Nikki, you said that he started to see a change in you, and that was part of what helped him to be supportive of you doing your own recovery work. You guys have also participated. Well, you've been on the podcast together as a couple. You've also participated in our marriage evolution group, which is for couples in recovery. It's a once a month deal. Your husband has the best RBF I've ever seen. I already knew because listen, we know from folks in Echoes that there are a lot of spouses out there who don't call it Echoes of Recovery. Don't call it Echoes of Recovery. They call it the Divorce Your Husband Club. And so when he came on, I see lots of nods and raised hands. When he came on the first time and he's got that stoic looking face, I muted and said, Sherry, that guy right there wants to kill me right now. But was that part of it too? Was his participating in, you know, in the marriage evolution where we had both sides, did that help him to accept the fact that this was helping you and this was a good thing?
Yes. And I think him also meeting you in person on the retreat for the marriage group, or the marriage retreat, was also beneficial because he got to see like how you guys are as people, and you're not just like leading us into conversations that may make us decide to leave our husbands or not. So this stay or should I go thing, I think it was just very intimidating for him. And you know, when I gifted him your book for Christmas, I'll never forget, like, I was scared to do it because, like, he had this negative attitude about echoes at that time. And I was just like, read it, you know? And I kind of had the same thoughts on this intimacy intervention thing. I'm like, just do it. I'm like, if Matt and Sherry are saying to do it, just do it. Trust them. But he's had such a change of heart, you know, seeing the differences, and he supports it 100%. And he knows that, I would do anything for my echo sisters. Like, he knows that it's changed me in such a way that, like, I'm just a different person, in a good way. But yeah.
That's great. That's great. Great to see the transition, mostly because I'm very afraid of him and I'm glad I don't need to worry anymore. That's good. Love you, Josh. Jane, we talk a lot about how lonely active addiction is, and even early sobriety. When we alcoholics enter early sobriety, all of our focus remains on ourselves because it's on us doing our recovery work. Do you feel like you are less lonely where you are now in recovery than you were during the active addiction phase?
That's a loaded question. I think before the addiction ramped up, I put a lot of my relating needs on my husband. We moved a lot, and so we were like each other's best friends, we were each other's lovers, we were that person you called 4 times a day. Like, I really didn't have a lot of friends because we moved around a lot. So right when it was getting really bad, that was a really lonely place because I had lost that person that I would go confide in. It was like one person, so I had to, it kind of forced me to have to go figure out how to get my needs met without my husband. Now, I got really, really good at that, to the point now in healing myself and figuring out who I am. Like, that need is met in so many other places that I find myself not needing much from him. And so that is really a struggle for him, because I think he misses that relationship, right? And he hasn't really done the same kind of finding those sources outside. But I'm healthier this way. So I think, just to go back on the question you asked before, too, like, I'm still recovering from this, right? But the cool part is that I've discovered this person in me that I'm not really like, I found myself from, like, I used to be that and I went back there. Like, this is new me who's been through this fire and coming out being very different, very, very different, and accepting who I am at a bigger pace, and not like, I don't pretend to be interested in things anymore. I don't people please anymore. And it really changed our relationship because we both did that for each other. So yeah, when you stay, you become different people, and you can't go back to that relationship you had because you aren't those people anymore. And so now what? Mm-hmm. Right?
But again, it comes back to, you've created a healthier version of you. Mm-hmm. And so you, whatever the relationship looks like, you are more capable to participate in that relationship in a way that keeps you safe and keeps you healthy. I just, mm-hmm. I think it's amazing how many of the answers to these questions keep coming back to you doing your own recovery, you getting healthy and stable and safe and powerful. Mm-hmm. And
there's a frustrating and like sad part of the discovery too, is I've realized through a lot of therapy that through addiction, our relationship became very transactional. Mm-hmm. It was to keep you this way, I'll do that. To keep me happy, mm-hmm. you'll do this. Mm-hmm. And when we take, you know, you go through so much emotional pain and stuff. So when you take that like dependency on each other away and all you have left is transaction, mm-hmm. it's very confusing. It feels like you've been playing this like never ending Monopoly game. And then all of a sudden mm-hmm. you step away from the table and go, what the hell have I been doing? Mm-hmm. I don't want to play the game anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hear Karen, but like, does that make sense?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely.
It's empty, you know, mm-hmm. it's just empty.
But then I know how to play the game, so mm-hmm. but I don't play anymore.
Yep. So wow. My thing when my husband came back was the scariest thing for me is that we end up playing those same roles again, whatever. And he was very supportive of my doing my recovery. And I think for the loved ones, we've got to get that this isn't fair piece out of the way, because it isn't fair. None of it is fair. And we were victimized. And I think we do have to love and nurture that part of us that was so hurt and wounded. But through our own healing and growth and recovery, we do not stay a victim. We just don't. We grow. We turn back into and expand from the people that we were created to be. We have our own inner confidence, which isn't so reliant on, do they like me with him? Because they don't like anything. So anyway, but I mean, it's a gift you give yourself. That's what recovery or discovery for the loved one is.
I feel like it's this weird like line, right? Like I feel most of us maybe on this call, we learned how to detach so hard and so well that it's so hard to reattach and find things that we can both come together on when we've learned so well how to do everything on our own. And mm-hmm. You know, like Jane said, she's found so many other ways now to basically fill her cup where she's not dependent on just their back and forth relationship. And so trying to find something to include our spouses in now, it's not as easy as it seems. But it was necessary at the same time. Like we had to go through that to develop a sense of self within us and the safety. And I think that's the most important thing to take away, is like you have to find yourself and make yourself safe. That's the most important thing in your relationship to start.
Yeah, it's a selfish process for us alcoholics when we dive into recovery, but honestly, it's a selfish process for the spouses as well, for the loved ones as well. Nicole, I'm curious, your husband's coming up on a year of sobriety, which is great. Super excited and proud about that. But you're a little newer in this recovery process than the other panelists. What's your response to this? How has the feeling of loneliness transitioned from when he was drinking that lonely to where you are now? Is it getting better?
It is. And it's, I was thinking about my response to when you're talking about recovery and discovery and all of that. And when I first discovered he was an alcoholic a little over 3 years ago, and we went through a couple of relapses, but when I first discovered that, it was such a relief because he was bad. You know, he would forget things constantly, and it was horrible. And so I thought, oh, this is great. It's going to fix everything. sweep it all under the rug. We just won't drink anymore. And so then everything that happened in the last, well, until last year when he finally sought recovery and started AA and SHOUT and went to rehab. Now it's not as lonely, I guess, now, but some days I put my walls back up as I was talking about in Echoes this week, you know, I just put my guard right back up. And so then that is lonely because I know it's important for my healing, but I also know that he's not the same person, but I don't know what I'm trying to say, but there are times that it's still lonely.
That putting your walls back up, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was listening to a nervous system expert, which, by the way, nervous system is my new, like, this is my thing that I'm on. So you guys can expect writing prompts and discussion topics around the nervous system.
Sorry, but I turned him on to this therapist. So sorry.
She was making the point that it's the nervous system that's in control of these triggers because it's there to defend us. Right? If we've experienced something and it went badly, and then we experience that first part of it again, our body is going to jump into, no, I don't want to be here. So you putting your walls up when you're triggered by something, like, I don't think that's something you should blame yourself for. That's your body trying to protect itself. But how does that feel when something triggers you and you're like, dude, no, you know, we're going back where we were. Do you shame yourself? Do you feel guilt?
Mm-mm. No. I think it depends on the situation and if I can tell what his intention is. With the most recent incident, I felt guilt at first, but then the next day when we had talked about things and he recognized that I had been guarded about something for days, and then I'm like, wait a second. You're playing a game again, like we used to do when you were drinking and you were sneaking around, you know, like, you know, something's wrong. And then you're going to play this game over here to maybe it's not this, or, you know, and so that replaced my guilt with anger. But I do, when the walls go up about something that is innocent on his side, he innocently does, and then it triggers me. I do feel guilt, and not shame so much, just guilt.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. Really interesting. Thanks, Nicole. Lori. So this is a tough one and you can decline if you'd like. But I'm curious, I and Sherry and I both, we think of trust and intimacy as being kind of connected, inextricably connected. And when I talk about intimacy, I'm not just asking about sex. I'm saying that feeling of emotional intimacy, that closeness. And I'm curious, again, you said it's been 5 years. Do you feel like you're making progress on trust and intimacy in your relationship at this point?
Yeah, we are. It's slower than I'd like. Of course, it's slower than he'd like. I think all of us wish this thing went much faster than it does. But yeah, it's definitely better. But it's, you know, it's hard when the old behaviors continue. It's just hard to trust. And I think for us, and you know, I've shared this with my husband, for me, it's the consistency. You know, he has always been kind of this up and down. Probably our whole marriage has been this, you know, up and down Jekyll and Hyde, like everything's great until it's not. And then it's really bad. And the fact that has continued in sobriety has made rebuilding trust really hard. And I think I'm realizing as well, my capacity to overlook things and to, my capacity is just diminished. I think I've been through so much that my fuse is shorter and my grace store is depleted. And so I just think that inconsistency has taken a toll. And so that's something I'm really working on is, you know, I've decided to stay. So I need to stay in this game. It's a long game. And so I think, you know, I had a bit of an emotional relapse last week and it was eye-opening for me. So yeah, we've made progress, but also there's, you know, setbacks and it's just harder to recover.
The setbacks are such a part of this. This is definitely two steps forward and one step back. I can so relate to what you're talking about. And I think, I mean, that is definitely a universalism Jane, you were nodding a lot when she was talking about consistency. What's your experience as it relates to consistency or your need therefore?
Consistently inconsistent. Basically is my relationship. But I think it goes back to like, I think in my own ego, like I'm a consistent human, but I know that's not as true as my mind wants me to believe. Right. But like, it's one of those things I project onto other people. Like if I can keep my shit together, why can't you? Right. And I think for a long time, I put a lot of those behaviors on the alcohol. And I thought when he got sober, like they would all go away. But some of them were inflamed in sobriety, and then, you know, some of them just hang around. And I think especially like our generation, where we're really starting to discover and explore the reasons for the addiction and the untreated like mental illness or traumas or learning discrepancies, like things we just had to suck up and deal with as a kid are now like talked about between parents, like it's no big deal. And so when I'm looking at my kids and I'm seeing all the things like they go through and having to deal with their behaviors, that's what it makes me like very aware of. Like we are all inconsistent humans dealing with our own crap with this facade that I have all my shit together. And it's just not true. So you have to be able to have some grace for the inconsistencies. But I'm telling you, when I have to repeat things 40 times and I write you a thesaurus of the things I need to feel good in this relationship and you don't read it, it makes me very wary of relationships, period. Like I had pink glasses on the whole time before this, right? So yeah, consistently inconsistent. Are there more consistent humans? Like I believe, because I feel like I'm one, but I also know that's my own ego speaking.
Well, you know, it strikes me, you're all mothers. And I think that there is a parenting role that you all occupy and do very well, where consistency is so foundational, like being that rock for your kids. And then, you know, we fly in and we're yelling one minute and we're, you know, upset the next, and then we're like, you've often talked, I would get the kids all wound up at dinner and then I'd be like, that's enough. Shut up. Why are you all wound up? And we are often the opposite of, and that's, I think there's some of that's alcohol. I think there's a gender component there. I just don't think we parent the same. This is one of those areas where the cliche fits, right? Then you pour alcohol on it. It's like pouring fuel on the fire. My inconsistency gets dramatically worse. And then, you know, in long-term recovery, I'm much more aware of the need to be consistent. So I'm artificially consistent now. Like it's not how I want to necessarily act, but I recognize the value, like the cats are still here. So I try to be consistent. But you know, there's a lot of factors that play in, and you described it really well.
Well, I think there is that consistency factor, but also how they're dealing with their own inconsistencies and own emotions. And we are not the ones that's managing that. Like Matt, you know, you still have ups and downs of good and bad days from outside forces, you know, work and stress,
amount of sleep,
all that stuff. But the way you're behaving and the way you're managing and the way you're expressing, hey, I had a really shitty night's sleep and soccer practice didn't go well, so I'm kind of in a grumpy mood. You can say that to me. Whereas you would just drink it away and then you would bark about everything.
That's exactly right.
So the way you're like managing your inconsistencies, you know, is so much better. Because I think Jane, you're right, I think you're right on too.
Because Matt's like, even I sometimes I have to fake it, but you gotta remember, we studied you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We know when you're faking your bullshit. Like Even if it's just happy and being like serving your family, I can tell that it's not, you're not in your body present in that moment. You're doing something out of that transactional like feel. And like, that's not consistency, right? That's not real. And I can feel that. And then that triggers me because I'm like, right? You're not real right now, even though you're trying. And I think that happens a lot in sobriety, is they want to, like, you want to try so hard to please your wife, please your kids, whatever. But like, it's still not you, right? It becomes this thing that you have to do instead of this thing you get and want to do to take care of us. And we can see right through that.
But if the real you wants to be flying off the handle, or wants to be, you know, really emotional, because the only emotional safe place I have is with my spouse, would you rather have me be that mess of a puddle, or would you rather have me be holding it together for the sake of the kids for right now?
No, I'd rather have you be like, man, I'm having a day. I'm going to go to the gym. Exactly. Work it out.
Communicate.
I'll come back and help later, than for you to fake your way through it. Because that's very reminiscent of those eggshells that we no longer want to even stand by. Right. So if you have your feelings, cool, it, recognize it, declare it, and then go deal with it. Or declare it, fake it either way. I got to deal with it.
Yeah.
Or unless you're in a situation where you can't fake it, where you have to just push through. So declare it, kind of fake your way through, like say you're at a family gathering and you know, you're having, you know, explain it, let it go. But then I think that's like helping you learn to manage the emotions. And then like at the end of the event, because I know this has happened for us, and I was like shocked that you were like, yeah, I was really faking it the whole time, because I was like engaged in with other people. But then,
oh yeah, that really upset you.
Yeah. And then, but I think that it helped you then realize, okay, that sucked for me, but I didn't have to go run to alcohol. I didn't have to be a puddle. I didn't have to leave the situation. I can learn those steps on how I can keep my shit together. I mean, I don't know any better way to describe it. You kept your shit together and it was hard, but you pushed through the hard. So then you learn, okay, there are going to be hard things. You know, if you would have said probably to me at that, because it was still early sobriety, if you had said to me early at the beginning, this is really sucky, I probably would have not enjoyed my time with this whole group of people that we hadn't seen in a long time.
Yeah.
You know, but because you'd have been that it kind of, yeah,
looking for what's going to happen.
Yeah.
He says it's sucky and there is alcohol here. What's he going to do?
But I think it like kind of gave you a little bit of a foundation of like, I can do hard things.
Yeah. You got to replace bad memories with good ones. And so that one, even though I didn't feel good, I behaved well. And it made it easier to behave well the next time and maybe feel good about behaving well the next time.
But can I feel authentic to you eventually? Like, does it ever feel like this is now natural for me to be this way?
Or is
it feel like where you feel like you have to fake it all the time?
No, I mean, no, I don't feel like I'm faking it. Like if I've had a bad day and I didn't get enough sleep, like that's the biggest driver in my mood anymore is sleep. And if I haven't had enough sleep, I can feel by the end of the day. But I feel like it's authentic. I know, you know, this is like, I'll just sleep tonight and hopefully it'll go better. It's not like I'm looking for the solution or I'm mad or angry or I'm suppressing anger. I'm just like, yeah, I got to wait till, you know, till it's bedtime and then I'll fix it for tomorrow.
And you know,
I think it's much more authentic now.
Yeah. And I think that you like know, I can handle these emotions. I don't have to run and hide and find something to manage my emotion or disguise myself or
what happens for me. And I think this is fairly universal, is I just start to feel bad about myself. And we alcoholics have a history with low self-esteem. And so where I go to when I'm tired or things haven't gone well is I'm not worthy. I'm not enough, whatever that means. But it is refreshing to be able to be aware of the fact that, you know, there's an easy solution. Go get 7 or 8 hours of sleep and you'll wake up feeling okay. So, Anyway, hey, enough about me. Good question. Okay, Karen.
Can I comment on that? Okay, so.
Please.
The growth, I think, was when you told her afterward, no, I was pretending. But of course, Sherry's going to have a trigger around that because mm-hmm. she's been manipulated and like, I thought you were, you know. So I think that honest communication, even if it's unpleasant or uncomfortable, is really key for the couple to be able to communicate honestly. And for me, even it was hard for me to say, I'm having a trigger because, you know, but a lot of times I just have, and now I look when I have a trigger, it's about, well, I just need some more healing here instead of trying to avoid it, you know? And I know that the communication skills for the alcoholic, in my experience anyway, you've gone from an easy fix to actually having to be there and feel and navigate. But mm-hmm. you guys took an easy way out and we had to deal all of this stuff. And so we've got all these triggers from what happened to us. But I think when one can be present enough with self, with myself and say, hey, I don't feel right. I'm going to bed. Don't you want to talk? No, not tonight. You know, that the old me would have never done that. Okay. Taking care of myself first, make sure he was okay, which he wasn't going to be anyway. So for him to start saying, even if his feet hurt or he had a bad day at work, then I know who I'm dealing with instead of some shit coming my way that I'm unprepared for. So that's great to own. When both of us start owning our own truth, that builds connection for me.
You're right. And it is such a hurdle because we did have that, you know, I like to call alcoholism a maladaptive coping mechanism, mm-hmm. but the words coping mechanism is in there. Like, it worked for a while and then it started making everything a mess, but then that's the only thing we know. So we keep going back to it. There is a soothing component to it, even though it's at the end numbing. Of the day, really, really
it's
bad.
It's not always the anger. Like, my husband goes more towards the people pleasing. So mm-hmm. when he's feeling the feelings, he'll serve me to get that like good feeling, but I can tell that's what's going on.
Yeah.
Like, you live through this kind of mental, like I can tell that's what's going on. So it's not always like then you're angry and grumpy and whatever. Mm-hmm. I think we've all heard that thing, even in NA, like if you serve others, then it'll fill you. But if you're mm-hmm. the reason you're serving others is to get mm-hmm. filled right now, like that comes off real inauthentic. Right, mm-hmm. but I can tell he's trying to like figure it out, but mm-hmm. I just don't have the patience for the manipulation anymore. Mm-hmm. And that is what triggers me is the mm-hmm. inauthentic part. Mm-hmm. Even when he's, you know, doing the greatest nice things for me, so it really like screws with your mind too, because you're like, thank you, but mm-hmm. it has to be easier, I guess. Is
that- That ties in so closely with what we've learned from folks who have been in alcoholic relationships where the drinker lied and hid the alcohol. We've heard that the lying and the hiding, that's betrayal. That's worse than the alcoholism. And so here in sobriety, if there's inauthenticity, I mean, that's just that's just a long word for lying. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some differences, right? You're not intentionally necessarily inauthentic. Sometimes that just, that happens.
But
it's
nobody
a
likes
defense
a brown,
mechanism.
Nobody likes a brown noser. We don't want it in our partner.
It's so interesting how those are connected.
Yeah. I do remember some of those times where I'd be like, if you're just trying to suck up, you know, get something out of me or out of you or, you know, yeah. But that inauthentic feeling is kind of icky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lori, what's better in your relationship and what are you still hoping will get better? Can you talk about that a little bit?
I'm so glad you said that because the optimist in me has been like cringing saying this whole thing has been kind of a downer. And again, we're just being real, right? And and I still say it's still worth it. I personally, I have not ever regretted my decision to stay, even given all the hard. So one thing that's definitely better for us is the communication, you know, the point that Karen brought up about that honest communication. And we're kind of realizing, I don't know that we ever had that in our marriage. So we have a long way to go, but that is definitely, definitely better, is that honest communication. Also, the inconsistency is still there, but the frequency of the swing is much less. You know, that's his work. That's the evidence of his work, is he doesn't swing as deep or as often as he used to. And so, you know, that's, then the good times are, and the rebuilding, I like your point, Matt, about rebuilding and replacing good memories. There's a lot more of that 5 years out, you know, than there was in the first year. And so that really gives me hope. And it's those up times that, you know, that keep me going. I mean, we have had some awesome vacations and wonderful family time and a lot of really great moments. And I have to get better about reminding myself of those when, you know, when the dips happen. And I think the other thing is just realizing, because, you know, we're such in our own world when we're living with an alcoholic, and now just realizing, I mean, everybody's marriage has ups and downs. Nobody's marriage is perfect. Mm-hmm. And so I'm feeling like we're back in the world of normal now than we used to be. So yeah, a lot has improved.
Back in the world of normal. I love that. Nicole, how about for you? What's better?
Well, I agree with Lori. There's a lot that's better, even though, you know, I'm only not even 1 year to her five. And even though I was just talking about, you know, an issue last week, his work this time with this period of sobriety is obvious, and his emotional relapses or his swings to the negative are less frequent. Also, most of the time, if I ask him to do something, he will actually do it. And I don't always have to remind 15, 20 times or just do the darn thing myself, because he keeps forgetting. I can see, as you guys know, we've had a lot of trauma, even in as if sobriety isn't hard enough. We've had a lot of other external traumas that could have completely derailed our recovery. They could have sent him spiraling back to drinking. They could have sent me screaming out the door, and we've held on, you know, and it's not, and for the most part, it's been side by side, you know, we're going to face this together, and not like enemies. But I feel like if what we've faced in the last year had happened during his drinking days, during his white knuckled sobriety days, I don't know that we'd still be married. I don't know that we would have survived it. So I think we are coming out stronger. We got a long way to go, but I can see a future where there is joy again, and where there is safety and peace and genuine support for each other. And I, you know, that's something that he admits he was emotionally immature. I mean, he stopped aging emotionally as a teenager, I think. And so our almost 17-year-old, I swear, is more mature than he is even now, but he's trying, he's finally trying. And so there is hope, and that's better for sure.
Oh, God, you, another great episode title. There is hope, and that's better for sure. Mm-hmm. I don't know what we're going to call this one. You guys keep feeding us great one-liners. That's good. Nikki, I know that for you and Josh, you guys have made a transition to him making dinner on Tuesdays. So I'm assuming that when we ask the question, what's better in your relationship, Crockpot Tuesdays, he's had some real, real good stuff, right?
Yeah. If this was a video, you can see Nikki's face. No,
it's better. It just depends on the week. But I mean, he's put in some effort. He's got some interesting ingredients I would not have thought to add to a crock pot. But yeah, I mean, you don't put veggies in there when, you know, they just end up being mush, if that's your thing, cool. But I don't like mushy zucchini. But anyways, Crackpots are still going, and that was kind of his responsibility one day a week for the day that I had to go into work all day. He still does it, even though he's actually working Tuesday evenings now, but he's still making the effort in the evening to put it together for the next day for us. Lots of things have changed. When I heard Lori talk about like the inconsistency and stuff, it made me realize that so much of that has gotten way better, that I didn't even realize it until she made a comment about it. Because when you're in this for so long, you almost start to not recognize good things because they're just like the norm now. But my husband used to swing pretty high and pretty low pretty often. And a lot of that is gone, and he's more aware now. He's able to point out his own behaviors and own them, whereas before that really wasn't the case. And so it's become a little bit more communicative when that does happen. Or he'll admit like that's part of his CPTSD, and he'll like apologize, or he's way better with our daughter and being more present with her and building their relationship together, which I was scared there for a while that it wasn't ever going to get to that point. But he has taken on the responsibility of taking her to swim class, and I don't no longer feel hesitant to let him do that. Like, I feel safe and that she's going to be safe. Not that he was like ever, you know, mean or abusive or anything, but it was just that the safety of knowing he's sober, like I don't have to worry about those things. We are still working on like the intimacy part. That's been the hardest to come back. And that's a lot of both of us feel like that. And I don't know. Some days I don't know how we're going to get through it. And other days it feels like just him coming upstairs to sit in bed and just talk for a little while feels so good to have that time together versus when he would just like isolate. And be alone, and there's a lot less isolation, I feel like. So it's a plus, but gosh, it's still hard, guys. Like, we're 4.5 years in and we're still trying to figure it out, and that just seems like the very last piece to put together to bring us back. But like I said, these little interactions have been helpful in that way.
Well, I think the intimacy being the last piece is, it should be the last thing to come back because it's tied direct. I mean, it is just sewn together to trust. And so trust and intimacy are so related. And I love the fact that he sits on the bed and you have conversations. That's emotional intimacy. That's really great. It's great to hear.
I don't worry about, you know, whether he's going to lie anymore. That's not really something I'm focused on. Like, I don't ever catch him in lies anymore, so that's another big improvement, that I feel like the trust is there in those ways. So I feel like there is hope for those things to come back too. So
yeah, that's great progress. Okay, last question. If you had Karen, let's start with you. If you had to do it over again, meaning if you were in the alcoholic relationship, so not back before you even met, but if you found yourself in the alcoholic relationship and you had to do it over again, would you make the same decision to stay?
You asked me the hardest one. I would say there are days where I would not, and I would have, okay, this is honest, okay? I would have maybe said, okay, I want you to win me back. I would have liked that. I got that romantic fantasy thing going on because a lot of it was just so heartbreaking for me. And he had to change really deeply. But he, the fact that he still is working hard to become emotionally available, I needed that for me. I would have loved for him to win me back rather than me still playing the same caregiving role for a long time and not getting the emotional connection. Okay. Because I'm somebody that thrives on the emotional connection. So that was really hard. But there are parts of it too. I'm going to tell you honestly too, that I would have, that have happened in the last 6 years, that I love those memories, you know, but it's kind of that consistent piece. And he's real helpful and he was real supportive of my recovery and he's real reliable, but that emotionally sober, the emotionally sober, yet alcoholically sober, but you got to become emotionally sober piece with him. He just stayed flat and stuck. And so I didn't have that engagement. So that part of it, we're still working on. Back to your other question that you didn't ask me. You know, no matter what happens, my hope for the two of us, and it's a day at a time thing. I think everybody commits their marriage one day at a time, really. If it becomes terrible, you don't have to stay. Nobody does. But to be friends after something like that is amazing, even if it's not a romantic fantasy.
Well, we appreciate the authenticity. I knew you'd bring the truth. Jane, how about you? If you had to do it over, you find yourself in the alcoholic relationship, do you make the same decision to stay?
I like who I am much better now, and I feel like I had to go through that fire to find that part. But yeah. Like, I don't think I would ever choose again in my life to put myself through that much trauma that I now understand I had power over. Mm-hmm. But I didn't see my power then. I didn't see my choices then. Mm-hmm. It did feel like I was stuck. So, but I needed to go through that to be able to know that about myself. So it's one of those things you hear people all the time. Oh, I don't regret going through any of my things. It made me who I am. Like, I believe that wholeheartedly, but I know going forward, there's no way in hell I'd go through that again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jane put it exactly right. I would never give up the work that I was able to do on myself and who I am now. But if I had to go through that to get that, okay. Not ever going there again, though.
Lori, you were nodding at that part, the growth that you've made personally, individually, in becoming the person that you are now. Is that like, are you, obviously you wouldn't wish this on your worst enemy. You never want to go through it again, but has it made it all worth it that you've grown into the person that you are?
Oh yeah. That's a huge part of what's made it worth it. And as Jane was talking, I'm thinking, yeah, I would go through it again, but I do it much better. and you know, that's the benefit of a group like this, is I hope that so many people can benefit from what we've shared and what we've been through, and that they can all do it better. I mean, I didn't have this early on, and I think I would have moved faster and gotten stronger quicker if I had it.
I mean, that's so well said. That's kind of the stated mission of this work, because when we meet people now, where Sherry and I are where we are at this stage of our relationship, you know, they'll say, oh, you know, how did you do it? I'm like, no, you don't want to do it the way we did it. It took us a long time and we did everything wrong. But the whole point of a podcast like this and conversations like this are helping people move through the muck a little bit faster. You don't have to make all the wrong decisions. We can learn from each other and only make a few of the wrong decisions on our way to things getting better. So that's so well put. In fact, it's so well put, I think that's a great place to end. Thank you all so much for being a part of this conversation. You guys brought the authenticity and the realness that we've grown to know and love from you guys. So thanks for being here as part of the Untoxicated podcast. Before you go, we hope you'll consider these three resources.
If you love or loved an alcoholic, we offer support and connection in our Echoes of Recovery group. Check us out at echoesofrecovery.org.
If you are a high-functioning alcoholic seeking methods and connection in early sobriety, we're ready for you at shoutsobriety.org.
No matter who you are, there's something for you in our book, Sober Evolution, Evolve into Sobriety and Recover Your Alcoholic Marriage. Go to soberevolution.org.
For my wife, Sherry Salas, I'm Matt Salas. Thanks for listening to the Untoxicated Podcast.